Hi, and welcome to Intern Ready OBGYN, a podcast aimed at helping you excel during your intern year in OBGYN. My name is Dr. Lucy Brown. I'm a resident at Johns Hopkins and your host for Intern Ready OBGYN. Welcome back to Intern Ready. I'm your host, Dr. Lucy Brown. Today, we are going to cover your first clinic visit for infertility. Our guest host today is Dr. Ariel Valdez-Sinan, one of our chief residents, who is actually going to be a fellow in reproductive endocrinology and infertility at Johns Hopkins.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you so much for having me today. I love teaching others about the workup for infertility. It's a topic that can be really overwhelming, but I find that breaking it down into clear steps makes it approachable. My goal for this episode is that by the end, listeners will feel comfortable doing an initial infertility evaluation and starting to think through the different possible causes in a clear and practical way.
Let's start with the basics. What is infertility exactly?
So clinically, infertility is failure to achieve pregnancy after 12 months of regular, unprotected intercourse for patients who are under 35. For patients who are 35 and older, we actually shorten the interval to 6 months, and anyone who's 40 or older should be seen as soon as they start trying. We do not wait for those patients. Ovarian reserve and egg quality change with age, so we want to act sooner.
Any situations where you'd see someone even earlier than that?
Yeah. So immediate evaluation is warranted if someone has known oligomenorrhea or amenorrhea, or if they have any known uterine or tubal disease or stage 3 or 4 endometriosis. Basically, if there's any red flag that suggests that their chances could be compromised, we don't sit and wait.
Got it. So when you sit down for the first visit, what are your go-to questions?
Like most initial visits, it's really important just to obtain a comprehensive history. In addition to general medicine and surgical history, make sure to focus on GYN-related history. It's important to obtain a menstrual history, specifically figure out if their cycles are regular. Periods are a very useful clue in the evaluation of infertility because a regular period typically suggests that someone's ovulating. But I have to warn you that it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. About a third of people with regular cycles can still be anovulatory.
Oh.
I know. So helpful, but not the full thing. Gather a full GYN history, including any pelvic infections, sexually transmitted infections, known fibroids, or endometriosis. And also make sure to ask about any prior pregnancies with previous partners.
And what would it mean if they had pregnancies with previous partners?
Patients who have been pregnant before are considered to have secondary infertility, whereas patients who have never been pregnant before have primary infertility. This nuance is a little bit useful when you're prioritizing different causes of infertility. I also gather a social history for tobacco, alcohol, and recreational drug use because the use of any of these things can be associated with infertility.
Yeah, I know that tobacco use can be associated with like tubal scarring as well. Is there any information on the partner that you need to know?
That's a great question. So pregnancy requires two to tango, if you will. So you need to obtain a medical and reproductive history on the partner, and that's equally as important.
Anything else to think about when considering the couple together?
Yes. Make sure to ask about intercourse frequency. You would be surprised that people forget to ask that question when talking about fertility. So ideally, patients should be having unprotected intercourse about twice a week. Sometimes people overcomplicate the timing around ovulation, or they're not having sex enough due to stress or just logistics.
Got it. I definitely have been somebody who's forgotten to ask.
It's a total, yeah. We get so focused that we forget about a thing that's very paramount.
Right, the whole point.
Exactly.
So moving on to physical exam, anything special that we need to focus on?
So, of course, standard vitals, weight, and BMI are important because extremes in these can affect fertility. Also, considering checking the thyroid and doing a breast exam to look for any galactorrhea if that's indicated. Look for signs of androgen excess. So this can show up as acne, hirsutism. And during the pelvic exam, make sure to take note of the uterine size, shape, mobility, and if you sense any adnexal masses or tenderness.
Got it. So now we've gotten our history and performed a physical exam. And where do we go from here?
So at this point, it's necessary to start thinking about your differential for possible causes of infertility, and that will guide you for your next steps of what is in the evaluation.
Got it. Thinking through all the possible causes of infertility sounds quite intimidating, especially for an intern clinic.
Oh, 100%. And as an intern, it's honestly just most important to think through the possibilities and generally how you'll evaluate for them. I'll talk to you through the framework I use when thinking about infertility. I often group things into three practical buckets. I think of female factor, male factor, and unexplained. I'm using those terms for simplicity during workups, but I also want to acknowledge that there's a wide spectrum of gender identities and reproductive anatomy. For example, a patient identifying as a male may have a uterus and need to undergo uterine evaluation. Mm-hmm. Every patient and partnership is unique, and so we want to tailor our approach accordingly.
Understood. Do all cases of infertility fall neatly into one of those buckets?
So in reality, most cases are mixed, but generally male factor contributes to infertility in about 40 to 50% of couples, and about 30% of couples with infertility are diagnosed with unexplained infertility.
Can you walk me through what you mean by female factor infertility? Again, acknowledging that the term is a simplification and does not encompass the complexities of gender identity.
So this can be broken down into three further categories: ovarian, tubal, or uterine. A way that I remember each of these is literally thinking about the journey of a little egg. It starts in the ovaries, it meets the sperm in the fallopian tube, and then the fertilized egg ultimately implants in the uterus. So there can be issues with that egg along that whole journey that can cause infertility issues.
I like this thought of tracking the egg on its way from the ovary to the uterus. How can you evaluate issues with ovulation?
So as I mentioned earlier, regular periods can be indicative of ovulation, but are not 100% reliable. So what you can do to confirm ovulation is you can collect a mid-luteal phase progesterone. So this would be about 7 days after ovulation. Mm. So if you think about someone who's having a 28-day cycle, you would obtain labs on day 21. A value of greater than 3 typically suggests ovulation.
Other than lab work to see if someone's ovulating, what other evaluation is recommended for ovulatory dysfunction?
Yeah, so, well, one thing to consider is if they are having ovulatory dysfunction from an underlying disorder. For example, polycystic ovarian syndrome, which many of you know as PCOS, is the most common form of ovulatory-related infertility. PCOS in itself is a complex disorder way beyond the scope of today's podcast. But briefly, if you want to think about that evaluation, that involves obtaining an LH, FSH, and testosterone. Ovulatory dysfunction can also be caused by thyroid disease and hyperprolactinemia, so consider ordering thyroid function studies and a prolactin only as indicated.
It sounds like these all involve the ability of the ovaries to release the egg. Can there be issues with there even being eggs to release?
Yeah, so we refer to the total supply of healthy, immature eggs in a patient's ovaries as ovarian reserve. Mm-hmm. And so in cases of primary ovarian insufficiency, that ovarian reserve is really diminished.
And how can you get a sense of someone's ovarian reserve?
So early in a patient's cycle, you can perform an ultrasound and obtain an antral follicle count. You can also obtain an anti-Müllerian hormone, which is also known as AMH. A value of less than 1 suggests a decreased ovarian reserve.
So if someone has an AMH of less than 1, does that mean they have that diagnosis of infertility?
So not necessarily. There is some nuance in the interpretation of AMH values. To become pregnant, all someone needs is just one single egg to become fertilized, so a low AMH doesn't mean that can't happen. So just keep in mind that AMH estimates ovarian reserve and responsiveness to the gonadotropins that are used in oocyte cryopreservation and in vitro fertilization.
So AMH is helpful, but it's not like the last word. Thinking back to the journey of the egg, what is the next step for evaluating the fallopian tubes?
Yeah, so for tubal patency, we do an HSG, also known as a hysterosalpingogram. It's the classic first test. It's the gold standard for assessing tubes. And for that, a radio-opaque dye is injected into the uterus through a catheter in the cervix. An X-ray is taken to visualize the dye filling and then spilling out of the fallopian tubes. If there's a blockage or a hydrosalpinx, we often recommend salpingectomy before undergoing IVF because hydrosalpinges can impair implantation and IVF success.
And on journey of the fertilized egg, we have now reached the uterus. Do you start with a standard transvaginal ultrasound?
So while that is the imaging modality of choice for other GYN workups, we actually typically recommend a saline infusion sonogram, which you may have heard of referred to as an SIS. And as that name suggests, the uterus is distended with saline at the time of the ultrasound. Since the uterine cavity is a potential space, that distension allows for visualization of lesions that may be obscured when those uterine walls are collapsed. Mm. And so during that uterine evaluation, we're looking to see if we see anything as like polyps, fibroids, a septum, or adhesions. Follow-up hysteroscopy is both diagnostic and therapeutic when needed.
Now that we have thought through the journey of the egg, let's talk about the other half of the equation. What do we do for sperm evaluation?
So semen analysis is a must early on in the evaluation. It's straightforward and it can guide next steps. If access or insurance is a problem, there are actually some good at-home tests that you can buy on the internet that are helpful as a screening step, but ultimately a lab-based semen analysis is the gold standard.
And if there are no abnormalities detected in such like a thorough workup, is the couple then diagnosed with unexplained infertility?
Exactly. And it understandably can be a really frustrating diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I think it also demonstrates just how much more we need to learn about the process of conception.
That's a super helpful overview of the workup of infertility. Would you be able to give us a quick recap?
Of course. So first to know is what the definition of infertility is, and it's a couple that's been trying to conceive for at least 12 months if under 35, or for at least 6 months if they're over the age of 35. Take a really thorough history of both the patient and their partner, mm-hmm. and pay close attention to their menstrual history. And also ask the patient and their partner if they've had any other pregnancies from previous relationships. And of course, perform a physical exam. And aside from looking at vitals and BMI, look for any signs of androgen excess and thyroid dysfunction.
And make sure they're actually having intercourse.
Yes, unprotected intercourse is a must.
And with many possible causes of infertility, you think about them in broad categories to help organize your thought process for workup, right?
Exactly. I think of my little buckets. So I think of my buckets of female factor, male factor, and unknown infertility. And then female factor infertility can then be further separated into ovulatory, tubal, and uterine etiologies of infertility.
So for workup of ovulatory factors, you'd begin to think about getting labs to look into like PCOS and thyroid dysfunction, right?
Exactly. And you should also get a sense of the patient's ovarian reserve with an antral follicle count and an AMH. For the purpose of an intern clinic, that is definitely a reasonable point where you can refer your patient out to REI. And the next step in our journey of the egg, we have the fallopian tubes and the uterus. And to evaluate the tubes, you get an HSG to look at patency. And then you would also consider getting an SIS for a better evaluation of the uterine cavity, which may or may not require a follow-up hysteroscopy. And of course, don't forget to evaluate the sperm with the semen analysis.
This was a super helpful run through. Any other pearls for our listeners before their first infertility clinic visit?
So in the setting of an intern clinic, it is most important to get a good history and physical and just start thinking through the differential. Review with your patient that there are many causes of infertility. The process of workup requires elimination of these possibilities. And so use diagrams and pictures to physically walk them through that ovulatory, mm-hmm. tubal, and uterine factor infertilities just as concepts. And if the patient has met criteria for infertility based on the length of time that they've been attempting pregnancy, it is appropriate to refer them to REI at that point.
And then any last-minute resources you would recommend if listeners want to review this material again, and we will also be including the show notes as well.
Yeah, so the ACOG committee opinion number 781 is a really good starting point. And then ASRM publishes guidelines that are also really helpful resources.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Valdez-Simon. That's it for this episode.
Thanks for listening to Intern Ready OBGYN. We hope you found today's podcast helpful. Don't forget to subscribe below, rate the podcast, leave a review, or suggest a new episode.